second lecture. And so let me first briefly recapitulate what we have done yesterday. We have discussed the existence of integrals of motion. So an integral of motion is something that actually, you know, if you evolve that a long time, you get zero. So basically, it's something that does not change along the trajectory. You carry the same value along the trajectory, and that's what integral of motion is. And interestingly, you know, it can be a function of q, q dot. So now it's a fundamental result of Noether that you know, these integrals of motion, their existence is in one-to-one correspondence with global continuous symmetries of the system. So global means when I am actually looking at these variations, delta t and delta q, I choose them to be a constant, and it is a symmetry of the action without using the equations of motion. It has to be true of shell. It has to, I just, you know, find this thing here, I plug it into the action, and I see the delta s is equal to zero. So then it's a global symmetry. Continuous means that I can make the parameter of these transformations arbitrarily small, as opposed to discrete, where there's a finite value for that. All right, so let delta be the symmetry. And so I'm writing here delta tilde s equal to zero, but more generally, you can actually put a total derivative. So we would have an integral over total derivative, or in field theory, you would have an integral of a divergence of some vector field. And then you would still have a symmetry. So this can be a little bit generalized. But anyway, the statement is, if I find this delta tilde t and delta tilde q, this is my integral of motion. So whereas to find this is straightforward, so I will show you in the proof in a minute, finding those is very difficult oftentimes. Okay, very good. So here, you know, we consider these general transformations of q and t. So whereas when we are deriving the equations of motion, we use the variation delta without tilde, use this one here. And that is a special variation which leaves time untouched. So we don't do anything with time, we fix time and do the variation of the fields. As opposed to this, we now do variations of both. We do variations of time. We go from t to t prime by delta tilde t. But we also do the variations in the fields. And there is no any restrictions on these. So we don't have to have fixed endpoints or nothing like that. We just consider, you know, two nearby trajectories and go from qt to q prime of t prime. And so this is your delta tilde q. So now from the picture, you can convince yourself that this identity is true for the q. And then because it's true for q, it should be true for any function of q and q dot. And so you should, more generally, you should have this identity over here. So if you don't believe the picture, you can actually derive this very simply. So you have delta tilde of q of t by definition was q prime of t prime minus q of t. This is how we defined it. And now you do the Taylor expansion on the first term. So I change t prime to t. So this will be q prime of t, and then plus delta tilde t d u prime of t dt plus other terms, and then minus this q of t. I'm just changing, taking the first two terms in the Taylor expansion.
Is it q prime of t prime or?
Okay, very good. Is it or? Well, it doesn't matter because it will be a higher order term, right? So it would go somewhere here. So you can put here t prime or t, it doesn't matter. Yes.
It only end up being like the higher order term if you could separate. So if you had like q of like t plus, you know, delta t or something, wouldn't it only end up being higher order if you could kind of split that function and make q of t plus delta t into q of t plus q of delta t?
I don't know. I don't. Well, I think it's fine. Sorry. All right, so now grouping the terms, you group these two terms. This is precisely how we define delta Q of t. Okay. And so similarly to dropping this t prime, I can drop the prime on this guy here, right? So I will have that this is equal to delta Q of t plus delta tilde t d, and now I'm changing this guy to Q of t dt plus high order, and that's my identity, which I have over there. Finally, what we will need for the proof is this very simple identity. So we know that delta tilde t is t prime minus t. Okay. So what happens if I differentiate this? So what happens if I do d of t delta tilde? Well, by definition, this is dt prime minus dt. But I can take the d out, whatever that means. So it's d, delta dt prime. No. Fine. Dt prime minus dt. And so this is, I can put the delta inside. It's like d of delta t. And now I can differentiate by dt. This is really stupid. D delta tilde t dt. And I can multiply by dt. And that's a trivial identity which we will use as well. OK? This is like really doing physics, well, math, the physics way. Anyway, so we have these two important identities. So now we can prove this theorem here. And you will see it's like two lines or three lines. So now the proof. And why I'm going through the proof is really constructive proof. So it really gives you what this I has to be. So that's why it's really nice. So let's look at what this variation delta tilde s really is. So delta tilde s, very good. So we know that s is an integral of L dt. But now we have to vary both. You have to vary q, and we have to vary t as well. That means also varying the integral measure. OK, so we have now two terms. So this is a sum of integral delta tilde acting on L dt, but also L delta tilde dt, right? So we have now two terms here, because we vary both t and q's. But t is also contained in the integral measure. OK? So L, what is L? L is a function of q and q dot and whatever, right? So we can use our miraculous identity here. So we have to calculate delta tilde on L. It should be delta of L and then that additional piece over there. OK, so this is an integral of delta L dt plus delta tilde t times dl over dt dt. And then I still have the second term, plus L delta tilde dt. OK, I can take the dt out to just make it simple if you want by doing this trick. I'll just divide by dt and multiply by dt, as we have done over there. OK, and I can swap these two, as we have done over there. So I can do d. So this thing here, actually d of delta tilde t by using that trick over there. OK, so now this is amazing, because you see that we can actually group these terms together. OK, so this is an integral of delta L dt. And then plus, so you see that I'm differentiating L here, or I'm differentiating t. OK, so I can group these two terms, and I will have it's a d over dt. Delta tilde t and L. Yes?
Why do delta tilde and d by dt commute?
I thought this is what I just derived here. So in some sense, here for p is trivial. For anything else, it's non-trivial, right? So they don't commute if you act on q and whatever, it doesn't. But for t, it's just by definition, it's just, you know, what it could be, right? It's just t prime minus t, right? And there's no funny business there, right? So really the difference is like I'm changing the t, but if you just act on t, yeah. Okay, so very good. So you see that, you know, the variation delta tilde s just gives you, you know, the standard variation on delta L dt, which we know from the equations of motion. So this we know from EOM derivation, right? Plus some boundary term, right? So there's a boundary term. This is a d over dt of something here. And if I integrate it, it will be a boundary term. It's precisely this boundary term which we are interested in, basically not as theorem, right? So in the end, you want to impose the equations of motion on shell, so everything in the bulk will vanish, right? Because of the variational principle. So what we are really after when we are looking at the denoted as theorem is the boundary terms. Okay, so now we can do the final step. So we have to do the variation of L as we have done it for the equations of motion. Right? It's the standard variation of L. So how did it go? So we just varied L with respect to Q and Q dot. And then we got the Euler-Lagrange equations in the bulk. Plus, we had to integrate by parts. We had to actually pick up a boundary term. Right? So now let's write that boundary term and combine it with this boundary term here. OK, so does anybody remember what the boundary term was? Not really. We would have to do variation. Okay, so the boundary term is just d over dt. And then if you look at your derivation, it's dl over dq dot delta q. So that's the boundary term coming from here. And then we have this boundary term plus l delta tilde t. So that's our boundary term. And then we have the Euler-Lagrange equations plus Euler-Lagrange equations and the whole thing. Is dt. Lagrange equations, delta q. Everybody happy so far? Okay, so we are almost done, right? So very good. So that's our variation, the general variation. We have done it off shell, right? We haven't used any Euler-Lagrange equations so far, right? If we have a symmetry, this has to be equal to 0. So this is off shell. So no matter what. And it's the fact that we have a symmetry. So this is, no matter what we do, it's equal to 0. However, when we are on shell, when the Euler-Lagrange equations are satisfied, and this time is equal to 0. So this is equal to 0 on the shell. Right? When the Euler-Lagrange equations are 0, well, this is 0. That makes sense. OK, very good. So when we are on shell, we have 0 equals to, you know, integral of this, you know, boundary term. OK, so in other words, we can identify this thing here inside to be our I. So we have I equal to dl over dq dot delta q plus l delta tilde t. And we know that an integral from t1 to t2 d over dt of I equals to 0, of course, this is equal to I at t2 minus I at t1. So in other words, if we start in some, so in other words, E at T1 equals to I at T2. So if we start with some initial time and T2 is an arbitrary later time, the value of I is preserved along the evolution of the trajectory. This is precisely what conservation means, right? At any later time, the value of I is the same as the value we started with. Okay, so I is conserved, and that's our integral of motion. Just constructed it. Okay, so now if you look at the expression over here, it's not quite the expression I'm giving you. The only difference is that here we still have written delta instead of delta tilde, right? So if I put the delta tilde back, I will have that I is equal to dl over the q dot, and then instead of delta q, I'm writing delta tilde q minus delta tilde t d over dt, and now the function which we differentiate is q, and then plus l delta tilde t. Right? So I just want to write my integral of motion in terms of the variations which I am actually considering in my theorem. Right? And so this, if you expand that, precisely, will be a double. Isn't this beautiful? So remember, just, you know, Noether's theorem is all about boundary terms. So in the equations of motion, when you're deriving them, just throw away the boundary terms, right? You don't care. What you are really interested in, how the bulk motion works, right? Noether's theorem is contrary to that, is you want to pick all the boundary terms and group them together. And this is what gives you the conservation. Right, so this is how it works. Questions? Everybody's happy with that? Yes.
Two things. One, the dq over dt, that's q dot, right? I'm not.
Yeah. Sorry. Of course.
And my other question is, can you talk a little bit about what it means for what this off-shell symmetry idea means?
So basically, you want to really geometrize physics. So you're asking, you know, what transformations I can do to the system so that my system does not change, really, like, right? And that has nothing to do with this time evolution, if you want. There's nothing to do with the dynamics of the system. It's like, can I rotate the system and see that the system is exactly the same? I have spherical symmetric potential, for example, right? I rotate things around. It doesn't do anything. But it has nothing to do with the dynamics, right? So I have to really, when I'm asking, is there a symmetry to the system? I cannot involve any dynamics, right? I'm just looking at the, you know, properties of the configuration space, if you want, and asking, you know, what are the symmetries, right? So that's why you have to have that, you know, the transformation has to leave the action invariant off shell, right? You're just really asking what the symmetry is, and that means off shell, no dynamics involved. What is the symmetry of the configuration space, if you want? More questions?
If the Euler-Lagrange equation would not hold true, will we still have some kind of a charge?
Well, it makes sense to talk about conserved charges only when actually the dynamics is involved, right? Because you are asking what actually is preserved along my dynamical trajectory, right? So it doesn't make sense to talk about integrals of motion without the actual dynamics. It's only defined when you have Euler-Lagrange equation satisfied. All right, very good. So we have Noether's theorem. You will see another one in your tutorial, another version of that, which I still don't understand. And you will see it's very, very confusing. But this is very explicit and very, you know, you can really do all the calculations.
I'm sorry, I must have missed something. Where did the off-shell equation for the integral of motion come from? Because the term for q dot is not here because we're talking about off-shell. Being off-shell. So.
You mean this thing here?
Right.
No, yeah.
No, okay, that I understand, but for the on-shell case, you said that the Euler-Lagrange equations should, by definition, satisfy. and we have dl over dq dot delta q plus l delta tilt t, which and we define that as our charge, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is basically the equation up there in the Noether's theorem.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sorry.
So this is precisely what I was doing here. So this is your conserved charge as we have calculated it, right? It's precisely that. But the point is that you know this is written in terms of the delta of the variation which we use in deriving equations of motion, right? But that's not what we want to do. We want to write it in terms of delta tilde. But we are using this identity between delta and delta tilde again. So basically expanding this term, right? So it's over here. And then if you group the terms together, it will give you the right eye. Thanks. All right, let me move to a different chapter now. We now understand all of Lagrangian mechanics now. Let's go to the Hamiltonian one. Okay, so chapter 2, Hamiltonian mechanics. And part A will be Hamilton's canonical equations. As I have in my notes, apparently Hamilton formulated these in 1834 at the age of 29. So you still have time to do some breakthroughs. I'm already. All right. So the idea of Hamiltonian mechanics. So in the Lagrangian mechanics, we dealt with the configuration space, which basically like a picture of the system. So we took a picture, and then configuration space really included just the positions, the generalized coordinates, but didn't include velocities and stuff like that. So now Hamiltonian picture actually extends this. It really describes the state of the system by including the velocities or momenta, if you want. Right? So the key idea is to enlarge the stage, if you want. And so going from n dimensional configuration space to 2n dimensional a space. So whereas in the configuration space we really like we have like a photo of system. Here we really describe like the physical state. And the reason why we can do that is that here in the configuration space, we just have the coordinates qi, and here we have a pair of qi and pi. Oh, so we have generalized coordinates, but you also have generalized momenta. Okay, so that's the idea. And what is also very important is that in this phase space picture, we can really treat Q and P as completely independent variables. Okay, so this is very, very important. So these are treated as independent. So you don't really know that somehow the velocity is related to the position by doing the time derivative. You treat them completely independently, Q and P. Okay, so that's what's happening. So now what is this mysterious P? It's called canonical momentum. If we want to proceed from the Lagrangian picture to the Hamiltonian one, we can define it in terms of the Lagrangian. How do we find from Lagrangian what this momentum p is, and then, you know, the miraculous function of evolution, the Hamiltonian, will be given by the Legendre transformation of the Lagrangian. Okay, so let's pretend now we are going from Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian picture. In that case, the canonical momentum pj is just given by dl or dqj. Well, that's the definition. So I have L is a function of Q and Q dot. Now I differentiate with respect to Q dot, and I get my momentum here. So now notice I'm trying to write index J or I or Q and Q dot upstairs, and then I'm trying to write the index I or J or P downstairs. Okay, so that's a convention from general relativity, if you want, but the truth is that, you know, Q, let's say QI dot, is like a velocity, and that's a vector. Okay, but PI is indexed down, and the momentum is a covector. So it lives in a different vector space, if you want. But you know, if you don't know about anything about covectors or forms or whatever, just forget about that, right? But just to you know, stress that p is a different beast than the velocity, I'm writing the index down. Okay, that's a confusing remark.
Does the convention reverse if we differentiate with respect to an index lowered?
Yeah, exactly. So if you differentiate it somehow Hamiltonian with respect to pj, which is downstairs, you would get. Yeah. Okay, so now, you know, we have the definition of P. And then we say that the Hamiltonian is a Legendre transform of Lagrangian. So how does that go? So the Hamiltonian will be a function of QI, PI, and T. So that's the new function which we are constructing. And we are constructing it as PJ UJ dot minus L. Again, I'm using the Einstein summation convention. However, L is a function of Q and Q dot, right? But Hamiltonian is a function of Q and P. So we have to somehow eliminate the Q dot in terms of Q and P. And this is done from this relation. So in the end, what you have to do is that you have to plug everywhere for QJ dot, express it in terms of Q and P, and you know this thing here is done by inverting this relation there, right? So if you look at this relation over here, P is a dl over dq dot. So the right hand side is a function of Q and Q dot, right? So you have a dl over dq dot. So it's a function of Q and Q dot. So now I have to be able to invert this, write Q dot in terms of P and Q, right? So I need to write Q dot in terms of Q and P by inverting this relation over here. Of course, this may not always be possible. And if it's not possible, you are screwed up and you have to do some very dirty and complicated things if this cannot be inverted. But what it actually tells you is that if it cannot be inverted, there are some constraints in the system, or you know, it's a complicated situation. So in most simple cases, this can be easily inverted. I can write Q dot as a function of Q and P, and I can happily plug it into my Lagrangian, and I get my Hamiltonian. Okay? But there are situations where this cannot be done, and you will see one, for example, next week. Okay? So that's our Hamiltonian. Question so far? Okay, so we have enlarge our configuration space to phase space. We have independent Q and P. We now have new evolution function, the Hamiltonian, given by this. But the momentum is over here. So now what is our evolution? So there's a theorem. It says, well, a system of n second order Euler Lagrange equations, which we have seen yesterday, is equivalent to n first order Hamilton's equations. And these read as follows: P j dot dh over the qj with a minus sign, and then qj dot is dh over the pj. Okay. So that's our theorem. And basically, okay, so we are gaining something, we are losing something else. But it typically it's nicer to have first order equations than second order equations, but you get twice many of them, right? So now I have, instead of n second order, I have 2n first order equations for my Q and P. And so there's a mysterious sign minus here, and it's very hard to remember which one it is out of these two equations, which has the sign. So typically, just consider the free particle p squared over 2m is your Hamiltonian, and then you check which equation is actually the minus sign. All right. So very good. So I'm saying this is the theorem, and it should be somehow equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equations. And you can actually check that, right? So I take, there's very many ways how you can check that this is actually equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equations we derived yesterday. One way is to say, well, this is my Hamiltonian. I know the action is actually, well, my Lagrangian here is pq dot minus h, OK? And then I write down the Euler-Lagrange equations for this Lagrangian, OK? So the proof of this, for example, would be, well, I know that the Lagrangian is pq dot minus h, and then write Euler-Lagrange equations for q and p, and this Lagrangian over here. Right? So here I understand that this is Lagrangian is a function of q dot, p, p dot, and t. Okay, I treat q and p as completely independent. The function of q, q dot, p, and p dot, I vary q and p independently. So I get Euler-Lagrange equations for q and for p. This is my explicit expression for that. And I just derive that these equations are true. Okay. So the alternative, which is nicer, and let me just do it, is that, you know, let's just do everything from the scratch. Let's just do the variational principle again. Of course, it's the same thing. But this way is actually I sweep some important stuff under the carpet. So let's do it, okay? So variational principle. So we have that the variation of the action is zero. And so then we have delta E1 T2 of the Hamilton of the Lagrangian. So it's P I q I dot minus h of q and p dt, and then so this is your Lagrangian, and so let's vary that. So it's integral from t1 to t2, and then we have to write all the terms. So it's delta p I q I dot plus pi delta qi dot minus dh over d qi delta qi minus dh over d pi delta pi dt. Okay, and then as always, when you have delta of d of dt qi, you can swap the time derivative and the delta, picking up the boundary term and moving the dot onto this guy here, right? So this is equal to, so the boundary term is just pi delta qi t1 t2. And then in the bulk, it's minus that. So it's plus integral from t1 to t2. So let me collect the terms with delta qi. So that will be this one here. So it's minus dh over dqi. And then there will be another one here. And I move this derivative over that, so it's minus pi dot delta qi. We have dealt with these two terms. And then we have the terms with delta pi, and it's much simpler. So it's plus qi dot minus dh over dpi delta pi. And the whole thing is dt. Yes?
Sorry, I think I missed something. Where'd the minus
here?
Yeah, where'd that come from?
Okay. So this term is just the term. Okay, so this is just that. Right? But here we have delta of d over dt of qi. Right? So we want to swap the d over dt of this delta, which we can do, and then integrate by parts, right? And by integrating by parts, you get another minus sign.
Okay, thank you.
More questions? Okay, so the boundary term, fixed endpoints, as we always have, so this is 0 due to fixed endpoints. On qi, and then these variations are independent. So this has to be equal to 0, and this has to be equal to 0 independently. And we have the Euler, like the Hamilton's equation. So taking this variational principle, everything seems super, super nice and super, super simple and super straightforward. Yes?
What was swept under the rug?
I'll tell you later. So if you do it this way, everything seems fine, right? No problem whatsoever. If you do it this way, you know, things start to be interesting. So try to do it this way and try to think about what this actually means. Okay? And then we will come back to it, well, probably at the end of this lecture. So just wait. There was another question?
I think it was this thing that we're coming
back. Yeah, okay. Very good. So we have Hamilton's canonical equations. Yeah, I have this magic square here. So here we are using the Legendre transformation. So Hamiltonian is a Legendre transformation of the Lagrangian. So similarly, you encounter Legendre transformation in many other areas of physics. And so one of them is actually thermodynamics. So let me just do a remark. But I am not going to spend time on this. So Legendre transform is important in other areas of physics. And one a very important example is the thermodynamics, e.g., for example, thermodynamics, right? And so what is tricky though in thermodynamics is that you have more variables, basically. So whereas here, we are basically just changing one variable. We are going from Q to P, from Q dot to P. We're just changing one variable. In thermodynamics, you have more variables. You have volume, you have pressure, you have other things as well, right? So it's becoming more complicated. And that's why there is this magic square. You just draw a square, and that square tells you everything you need to know about thermodynamics, okay? So very tough square problem, okay? Very tough square problem. That's how you remember that. I don't have an idea how to remember the energies, but anyway. So there's an internal energy U. There's a free energy F. There is a, what is that? Gibbs free energy G. And then this one,
enthalpy.
Very good. So very good. So we have a square. We have some strange numbers, strange letters. But it wouldn't be magic square unless you had also arrows, right? You have to have arrows. And that comes from the fact that, as we know, the current in electricity always flows from plus to minus. So you have a plus here, you have a plus here, and you have a minus here, and a minus here. And then the current flows like that, as always. There's no any other convention that goes from plus to minus. Okay. Very good. So this magic square really tells you everything about thermodynamics. And it's up to you to figure out how this actually works. But basically, the statement is that it tells you about all the Legendre transforms, right? So for example, the internal energy, right, U, it's a nice energy which is minimized or extremized when it's a function of its variable. So it has to be a function of the entropy and of the volume, right? So function S and V. Okay. The free energy, though, is a function of volume and temperature. So as we go to the free energy, which is a function of volume and temperature, we have to basically eliminate the entropy and introduce the temperature over here. This is done by Legendre transform. Okay, so we have that F is U. And then as you go from the entropy to the temperature, there is a minus sign. Okay, so there's this magic minus sign here. It's U minus TS. So we are going from S to T. So that's the Legendre transform. But we all, of course, know that the T has to be similarly to the introduction of the canonical momentum given by the derivative of the old function with respect to the old one. So T is du over ds. Okay, so that's one example of a Legendre transform.
Could you repeat what you said exactly at the end? You said, what was the...
So the statement is...
T is equal to du ds.
So you can read everything about all the energies that you have over here, right? So in mechanics, you have only two. Sort of. You have the Hamiltonian picture and you have the Lagrangian picture. So we just have a line, sort of. Right. Oh, whatever. Well, you would have a triangle problem. Ah, it's interesting. But let's construct this for the mechanics. But anyway, for thermodynamics, it works like you have a magic square, okay? So you have the internal energy is a function of entropy and volume. The free energy is a function of volume and temperature. So if you go from U to F, you have to basically eliminate S in terms of T. This is done by the Legendre transform, okay? And so you go from, you know, the Legendre transform goes like that. It's precisely this formula over here. You have PQ dot minus L. It's a different convention. It's a minus sign. So it doesn't matter. So this is what we are doing. We are basically putting the old variable times the new variable. But we also know that the new variable has to be given by some kind of differentiation of the old potential with respect to the old variable, right? And then you can read the sign. Where's the sign? Du over ds. There's a sign. Okay. So that's you know, so that's how you do the Legend transforms. Second, there's also information about, you know, these Maxwell relations. So typically, you there's some nice relations between, let's say, dv over ds, how it is related to dt over dp. And that's read from triangles like that. So there will be a relation between dv over ds, dv over ds at constant p. And this must be equal to dt over dp at constant s. And you read the signs over here, so it's plus and plus. So after a sign, it must be true. It'll be plus, it'll be plus. So these are called Maxwell relations. And so on. So basically, the statement is this square is all you need to know about thermodynamics, and we can talk about that in tutorial if you are interested more.
What if you include the particle number?
Sorry?
What if you include the particle number?
Oh, then you would enlarge, right? You enlarge it, and then it will become much more complicated, right? So here I assume that really my basic variables are just V, volume, temperature, entropy, and the pressure. But once you start including additional ones, it becomes more dimensional, right? Okay, I spent too much time on this. Very good. So we have Hamilton's canonical equations. Let's introduce another interesting concept, which makes Hamiltonian picture very beautiful, and that's the Poisson brackets. So part B, the Poisson brackets. Let's do the definition. So let F and G be two phase space functions meaning they are functions of Q and P. Then their canonical Poisson bracket which we denote by f and g is a new phase space function and then the prescription how to calculate it is the one which is probably familiar to everybody here. It's just f and g. It's df over dqi, dg over dpi, minus, we swap the two, df over dpi, dg over dqi. I hope that's correct. Sometimes there's a different convention. There's a minus convention here. And so it can be confusing from text to text. All right, so that's the Poisson brackets. Everybody's seen Poisson brackets, right? Somebody? OK, good. So Poisson brackets are a nice quantity here. So let's have some properties. Which immediately follow from this definition over here. And so the first property is, you know, what happens when we choose f and g to be q and p, right? And this is called fundamental brackets. And then directly from the definition, so if I, for example, want to calculate Qi and then Pj. All right, so this will give me 1, this will give me 1, and that will give me 0. So Well, this gives me delta ij. Similarly, if you take qq's, qi, qj, you find zero. And if you take qp's, pj, you find also zero. That follows immediately from here. So this is all very simple. So why is this interesting is basically this is one way how to quantize your system. So in one way to quantize, a way to quantize is to say, well, I promote my q to some operator and my p to some operator. And then I say, and I replace my Poisson brackets to commutators between these operators. And then you impose the canonical quantization conditions, which are basically like these brackets, but now for all the operators and commutators. And so you do basically qi at pj at, and then instead of just delta ij, you put the h bar, delta ij, and then the rest will be zero. Okay. And so once you do that, you have quantized the system, and you can happily do quantum mechanics. OK, so of course, this is not true, but it's almost true. So for simple systems, you can do this easily. And you get some quantum mechanics. You get some operators. You get some properties of the system. And then the question is, actually, does it agree with the measurement and stuff like that? And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, right? And the reason why sometimes it doesn't is that there is no way how to derive more fundamental theory from less fundamental one, right? So the classical mechanics is valid under some conditions, and it's less fundamental theory than the quantum theory, right? So a reasonable question to ask is, well, if I have fundamental theory, quantum mechanics, then at certain limit, it has to give me back the classical mechanics. Right, so that's the right way. So I have fundamental theory. I take some limit of that. I get less fundamental theory valid in some regime. Right, so from quantum mechanics to classical mechanics, from quantum to classical mechanics is the the correct limit. That's the way that can be done. However, there's no way how you can go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics, right? In general, so this. Sometimes works, but sometimes it doesn't. You are basically guessing more fundamental theory from less fundamental one, and that cannot be done, right? So sometimes you're lucky, and then you guess the right thing, and it agrees with the experiment. But sometimes it doesn't work. So there are all these features like how you can do the correct ordering of the operators and stuff like that. But no matter what, how complicated your prescription is. Fundamentally, it cannot be done. Fundamentally, you cannot derive quantum mechanics from the classical one, right? Yeah, the only correct way is the other way around. Questions? Yes.
When we go from quantum mechanics to classical mechanics, the commutators become Poisson brackets, right? But the phase spaces are different objects in terms of, like, it's a Hilbert space going into a phase space. How does that make sense?
So I will show you one way how really nicely you can go from. Yeah, I'll show you one way how to go. Yeah. But anyway, so this is the right way. So this in principle can be done. This in principle cannot be done. It can be guessed, and you may be lucky that it's the right thing, but it cannot be done. All right. So we have the first property is the fundamental brackets. The second property. Is, well, there's a few algebraic properties. And there's a Leibniz rule and so on. So this anti-symmetric symmetric. From definition, there's this minus sign. So f and g minus g and f. It's linear, meaning that if I take a constant times my function f plus beta times g h, I can take this constant out. So it's alpha fh plus beta gh. It is a derivative, so it satisfies the Leibniz rule. So if you have a product of two functions, then you differentiate the first one. And then you differentiate the second one. Okay. So that's the Leibniz rule. And finally, it satisfies the Jacobi identity. And that is if you take Poisson brackets inside each other, so f, g, so there's one Poisson bracket, but you take a Poisson bracket with another one, h, and then you cyclically permutate all these things. So you send h to the first slot and f to the second slot and g to the last slot. So it's h, f, and g. So we have just rotated that like cyclically. And finally do the same thing once more. So plus g, h, and f, miraculously you get zero. And that tells you that somehow the Poisson brackets close on themselves, and they have some nice properties. And this will be fundamental importance for integrals of motion. So as you will see in your tutorials, if you have two integrals of motion, sometimes you get a third one and fourth one and so on. Okay. Okay. And so this, all these properties sort of like telling you that the structure actually of Poisson brackets forms Lie algebra and so on. Finally, let me calculate what df over dt is. Okay, so if we calculate a time evolution of some function f, well, this is df over dq. Qi dot plus df over dp bi dot plus df over dt if there's an explicit df. Looks like dt over dt, but it's df over dt. If there's an explicit time dependence, right? But now, Qi dot from the Hamilton's equations is dH over dpi. And pi dot is the first one, is minus dH over dqi. So now you start at that, right? And you see there's df over dq, df over dq, dh over dp, minus df over dp, dh over dq. It's precisely the Poisson bracket of f and g, and f and h. So this is equal to the Poisson bracket between f and h plus df over dt. So you can conveniently express the time evolution of functions in terms of the Poisson brackets, plus some explicit time dependence, but typically, you know, this does not happen. So you typically have, you know, observables which don't explicitly depend on time, unless you have some variable external field or something like that. So this is typically not there. So then the time evolution is precisely given by the Poisson bracket. Okay. Questions? I guess this must be too slow for you, right? Everybody knows all these things. But I think it's good to remind them. But, and the final property is that, really, if you have an integral of motion, so finally, for integral of motion, we have di over dt equals to 0. But so using the equation which I just wrote down, this can be written in terms of the Poisson bracket. It will be the Poisson bracket of I and h plus di over dt. So now, as I said, this typically does not happen. So that, you know, that your system will be explicitly time dependent, that your observables will be explicitly time dependent, or for the God's sakes, that the integral of motion will be explicitly time dependent. But of course, you can construct such cases where it is, and the whole thing is only conserved, right? But, you know, typically this is actually, you know, does not happen. And then you would say that, you know, I is an integral of motion. So definition, which is almost always true. Is that, you know, integral of I is an integral of motion. When actually the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian is equal to 0.
Can you talk a little bit more about physical properties of Poisson brackets? Like, are they introducing any symmetry that we're seeing them everywhere? This kind of stuff's like.
So.
Why is it a great way to quantizing by using this Poisson brackets? We're seeing it everywhere. Like, to any kind of symmetry?
No. Okay. So for now, let's just think about them as a convenient tool to express everything, right? Express all the mass. Right, so this is how I'm presenting it at this point. So you know, instead of working directly with these derivatives and stuff like that, let's just write a Poisson bracket, and it's so much nicer, right? And so you know, it's a convenient tool at this point. What the Poisson bracket is.
And a special kind of derivative. It's like we have derivatives in terms of Q and P at the same time, and they're like anti-symmetry because we have a minus.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like. It's like something special, like there is something, some special symmetry in all the physical systems that we can always see this special kind of derivative.
So, yeah, okay. So what it is connected to, so I don't know if you have taken a course on general relativity, for example. So in course on general relativity, you will learn that the fundamental object, which actually stands behind everything, is the metric. A metric is a rank 2 tensor, which is symmetric. So it's G alpha beta. Right, so G alpha beta, and it's a symmetric object, and it's really fundamental. And you can use it, you can write down the inverse metric, you can write lower indices, you can construct all the quantities out of the metric. Okay? So that's in GR. All the structure in Hamiltonian mechanics is based on the symbol object, omega alpha beta, which is called symplectic 2-form. Okay, so it's a symplectic, so that's the mechanics, and it's a symplectic 2-form. And that's the fundamental object of the importance. Contrary to GR, this is anti-symmetric, so that's why the 2-form. It's an anti-symmetric rank 2 tensor, if you want, with this. And so the anti-symmetry of this guy precisely enters, you know, the anti-symmetry of the Poisson brackets and stuff like that. So really, you know, you can start building classical mechanics, but just knowing there is this one object here, which satisfies some special properties. Okay, and so I don't know whether it's this is what it is. sorry. Okay, more questions. So we have integrals of motion, and this is true. So now you will prove in your tutorial is that if you take two integrals of motion, I1 and I2, you get something, right? Well, that something, let's call it I3, is again an integral of motion. And then you say, aha, so this is amazing. So if I can find two integrals of motion, well, I generate a third one. Then I take I3 with I1, I generate a fourth one. I take I3 with I2, I generate a fifth one, and so on. I keep going, and I integrate everything. And I have so many infinite number of integrals of motion. And in principle, although this is true, in practice, it typically does not work, because you very soon start getting zeros. Right, so I3, well, zero is also identically conserved along the motion, so it is also an integral of motion. But typically, you know, this does not work that beautifully as you might want. So integral again, unless zero. Okay, but nevertheless, it is quite useful, and in fact. Quite recently, we studied a system where actually you seem to be getting lots of integrals of motion which are non-trivial and interesting. But I don't know, you know, when the tower of these integrals really terminate or not. Well, it must terminate at some point, but how and why and where, we still don't know. So if you are interested in an interesting system, they can keep producing these integrals of motion. I can give you a reference.
Can I ask
something? Yes.
Work if you assume there is no explicit time dependence, or is it a general result, like defining new
integrals? So as I say, you know, you can artificially construct systems where, you know, this piece would play a role, but in real physical system, I have never seen that. So
what would be an example, actually? Like, do you have anything?
Well, you know, you start introducing explicit time dependence when you mess with the system with some external fields which are in time variable. Right, I put it in, you know, time-dependent electric field, something, and I don't consider the system including the electric field, but I consider only the system inside, right? And so this is how you introduce, you know, explicit time dependence, and then I've seen examples. I don't know what it was exactly, but where really this piece only this was not conserved, but the total only was conserved, right?
Do you need such a thing to deal with like friction or dissipative systems? It's like not even worth thinking about.
So typically it, you know, comes when you don't include the whole system, right? So when you consider only part of the system and you know or because you know for the whole system typically things typically conserved and you know if you include everything together then but once you split it into the system itself and the surrounding, then you can start getting weird things, right? Okay, so now the most important concept in Hamiltonian mechanics is that of canonical transformations. Part C, canonical transformations. And it's very, very, very weird concept, but it's also the most powerful one. So let me start with a definition. So a canonical transformation is a transformation of space coordinates (clears So I get new phase space coordinates, capital Q and capital P, and there will be functions of the old ones, small q and small p. Okay. So far, we have just a general transformation, so that wouldn't be a canonical transformation. So there must be something special about, you know, how to change these coordinates from small q and p to big q and p. And so the condition is such that, and this is weird, it preserves the form of Hamilton's equations. Okay. So really, what do I mean is that there must exist a new function h, or h prime, so that, you know, the form of these equations is still the same, so that the capital Pj dot is now minus dh prime over d capital Qj, and so on. That is, there exists new h prime so that the h prime over d bj is qj dot, and e h prime over e qj is minus bj dot. Okay. So that's my definition of what I mean by a canonical transformation. And this is very weird, right? So I can consider some transformations of the old coordinates to the new coordinates, but what I require is that, you know, I'm able to find a new h prime, which somehow is related to the old h, so that my equations of motion are still written in this way. Okay, so that this set of equations is completely equivalent to the old set of equations in the old coordinates. Okay, so that's a definition. Yes.
When you say somehow able to find h prime, isn't it just the result of the transfer, the small q's and p's going into big q's and p's?
Yeah. So if you just do a general transformation, then this will not be possible. I'll just give you an example of a transformation which is not canonical. Okay. I will not really prove it's not canonical, but it is not canonical, you have to believe me. But I'll sort of give you a hint why it might not be canonical. So the statement is that not every transformation is canonical one. And as I said, it's a stupid example. So let's consider a free particle. So let's consider that h is just p squared over 2m. Well, that's my free particle Hamiltonian in the old coordinates. And let's consider a transformation. Consider capital Q is a square root of small q, and let's say that the momenta are equal. So then you might guess that, and you know, so here I'm just, you know, giving you an example. You can actually show directly that, you know, this H prime would have to be like that. But anyway, so is capital P square over 2m. You may guess that, the Hamiltonian, which I am looking for, the new one, is actually the same one, right? It's just P square over 2m. But if this were true, well then, you can calculate what dH prime over dP is, capital P. Okay. So if you calculate that, it's P over m, just using all this thing here, P over m. Well, that is equal to small p over m by, you know, this transformation, which of course is equal to dH over dP, the old Hamiltonian divided by p. But we know that the original Hamilton's equations were that dH over dP is q dot. Right? But we also know that q is capital Q square. Okay? So this is equal to q, q, q dot. Okay? But if this were my right Hamiltonian and the Hamilton's equations were true, I would require that this is equal to capital Q dot. Obviously, it is not. Okay. So you know, I haven't proved that this is the right Hamiltonian to consider, right? But if I did, then I've shown that this is really not economical. Yes.
Is there like a way to show that properly, or is it like a search over all of the Hamiltonians?
Okay. You will see in a minute. Okay. So the statement is, not every transformation of the old coordinates to the new ones will be a canonical transformation. In fact, I just deleted this, you know, g and omega, right? So canonical transformations are such that if your omega is a nice form at the beginning, it will have a nice form at the end as well. So only those transformations which preserve the form of omega, the nice form of omega, are actually canonical transformations. It's similar to Lorentz transformations, right? Lorentz transformations are such that if you start with the metric, which is the Minkowski metric, minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, then you preserve the form of the metric of, under Lorentz transformations. Again, I do the transformation of coordinates, and again, end up with g, which is minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, Minkowski metric, right? So similarly, canonical transformations are transformations which preserve the nice form of this two-form omega.
I'm sorry, form like appearance or form like form? Preserve the form of omega, does that mean that you're preserving it?
Okay, so.
Preserving it exactly, or like you're preserving it?
So nice form for the metric in Minkowski case, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, and then 0 everywhere, and then 0 everywhere, right? The transformations which preserve this is the Lorentz transformation. Okay, so now if you have a two-form omega, it's an antisymmetric matrix. Okay, antisymmetric matrix has to have zeros on diagonal, right? And then it's antisymmetric, and you can always, you know, play with the eigenvalues so that actually the eigenvalues here there's a plus one here, there's a minus one here, a plus one here, minus one here, and then zero everywhere else. It's a nice form of omega, okay, of an antisymmetric matrix. So the things which preserve this form of omega are precisely canonical transformations. Okay. So Okay. Anyway, so this was just a remark. So now, how to construct or yes?
Sorry, for the omega,
at AB, what are the, in this matrix form, what is the vector, like the structure of the vector?
It is obvious, right? I have just things on the diagonal and zeros everywhere. So here, you split it into 2x2 blocks. This is a 2x2 block. This is a 2x2 block. This is a 2x2 block. And this is a 2x2 block. Okay? And so the statement is, you have sort of, again, a diagonal form, where you have 2x2 blocks on the diagonal. And then you have, it's anti-symmetric, so it's 0, 0. But then you have plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1. And then you keep going, another 2x2 block. 0, 0, plus 1, minus 1, and so on, right? If you have more dimensions.
Are you mixing your face? QP. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Precisely. Perfect. So that would be a QP, right? And so you would have like a only the terms which you'd like in the direction Q and P are non-trivial. But Q and Q is 0, and P is 0, and so on. Okay, so the statement, canonical transformations. All of them are generated by generating functions. Well, I haven't said anything. I generate something by generating something. Okay. So how do they look like? So the generating function is function f. And it's a function of one old coordinate and one new one. Okay. So where the old are small q and p, and the new are capital Q and P. Okay, so now obviously I can choose Q and P over here, and I can choose Q and P over there. So it's 2x2, 4 possibilities. Okay, so we have 4 possibilities. And so consequently, we have 4 kinds of generating functions.
By 4 possibilities?
Yeah. So the statement is I can always construct the generating function by choosing a function of one old coordinate and one new coordinate. I have 2 possibilities how to choose the old coordinate. It's either Q or P. And then I have 2 possibilities how to choose the new coordinate. It's capital Q and P. 2x2, 4 possibilities. OK? So for example, the standard one, the first one, which everybody considers, is that I choose my f to be a function of small q and then capital Q. Well, that's one possibility. That would be f1, typically. And you have f2, f3, f4. But you know, this is one possibility. OK. And so now where the devil hides, and I'll leave you meditate. What the hell is going on? It's OK. So we want to preserve the form of the Hamilton's canonical equations under the transformation. And to this purpose, we use the freedom in the Hamiltonian description in the definition of the Lagrangian and so on. OK. So we already know that the Lagrangian, if you change it by a total time derivative of a function of q and t, then the Euler-Lagrange equations remain the same. OK, so let's use this freedom, but now in the Hamiltonian picture. So now, using the freedom in definition of L, But now, in Hamiltonian picture, so again, I remind you, in Lagrangian picture, we can go from L to L plus d lambda over dt, where lambda is a function of q and t. Right? It cannot be a function of q dot. Okay, so very good. So we define a new action, which is an integral, well, of Lagrangian, which is pq dot minus h. And then we add or sub, well, by historical things, it's subtract the function, total derivative of a function, and you know nothing changes. Okay. Now let's ask, express what this thing here is. So it is equal to. PQ dot minus h minus df over. So now it's a function of small q and capital Q. So it's df over dq, q dot minus df over dq, q dot minus df over dt. And that's it. Now I group the terms together. So it's an integral of, let me take the q dot first. So what remains here is p from this term, and then minus df over dq. And then let's write the df over dq q dot. And then let's group the last two terms, minus h plus df over dt, dt. OK, I just grouped the terms together. I have not done nothing serious. OK. This is what it is. Another question is, what do I want? What I want is that the action looks as dq dot minus h prime dt. If the action looks like this, then h prime is my new Hamiltonian, and the canonical equations, which I get by you know repeating the variational principle, will coincide with, will give me the same Hamilton's canonical equation, right? If the action looks like this, then this will give me, by doing the variational principle, it will give me the right canonical equation. OK, very good. So let's compare this, what I want, to this, what I have, right? So very good. So I see a term which has q dot. Is this pq dot? I have to compare with this term. OK, so comparing this with that, I see that I can definitely achieve this by setting that capital P is minus df over the capital Q. Okay, so I achieve this by, you know. Then I look at, do I see any term with small q dot here? I don't see any term with small q dot here. So if I make this guy here vanish, this term will disappear and will not bother me here. So secondly, I want that p, small p, is df over dq by making this guy to vanish. Okay. And finally, I want to identify my new h prime. And I see that if I identify h prime to be h plus df over dt, then I am happy. Okay. So these are the conditions. So okay, let me say it differently. So I want to construct, you know, a canonical transformation. I choose a generating function f, whatever function I want. It would be a function of small q, capital Q, and t. Okay, very good. And then, how are these capital Q and capital P connected to the old Q and P? Well, through this relation. And this is my new Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is how you construct all canonical transformations, basically, is that, you know, they are in one-to-one correspondence with these generating functions, but there are, you know, ways how to really construct the transformation. If you know the transformation, on the other hand, you can probably construct the generating corresponding generating function by integrating these equations for f. Okay, so let me stop here. Questions? Yes.
The function f has to be a like a function of only q and p and not q dot. So, but here it is a function of capital Q as well as small q. So, is it somehow involved in q dot as well?
Aha. That's the thing which I swept under the carpet. So why don't you think about this till the next lecture? And we discuss it, we try to discuss it next lecture or during the tutorial tomorrow. But this is precisely the problem, right? So in the Lagrangian picture, the freedom was that I could go from L to L plus d lambda, which was a function of only q and t over dt. I couldn't have q dot because there's no way I could actually make that vanish, right? But somehow in the Hamiltonian picture, I am choosing my generating function to be a function of q and q. But of course, q is a function of small q and p, right? So suddenly, I'm choosing my f is actually a function of q and p, of both, right? It seems like it's a function of q and q dot, right? But what the hell is going on here? OK, think about that, and we can discuss next time, OK? It's precisely a very good point, very, very good question.